In his huge new book, The War of the World, controversial historian Neil Ferguson documents what he calls history's bloodiest century. That is the 20th century, 100 years of slaughter sparked by empires in decline, ethnic disintegration, and economic volatility. Now, he believes those factors come together in an overwhelming deluge of human hatred during the age of unparalleled human progress. He also cautions that these forces are at play today and may shape the history that will eventually be written of the 21st century. Neil Ferguson is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard University, a senior research fellow at Jesus College, Oxford, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, an op-ed columnist for the LA Times, and the author of several books. The newest is The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. Now, I always like listeners to get to know the person behind the ideas and the work a little bit. Why did you become a historian? And if I'm not mistaken, weren't you choosing your career path just as they were announcing the end of history?
Well, I think I'd already embarked on it just about the time that Francis Fukuyama announced the death of history, or the end of history, which was 1989, and I was just finishing my PhD at that point. So imagine my shock and horror at the prospect that my subject had been abolished. But luckily, I was in Berlin, actually, that summer, watching the disintegration of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Empire. And my faith was quite quickly restored that history was going to carry on, because this very obviously wasn't going to be a sort of utopian liberal capitalist paradise in which the rest of the world became a kind of mini-me America. So no, I didn't abandon hope of history.
What was it that drew you to it, though?
Well, I think reading Tolstoy, to be honest. I remember one afternoon taking a day off school, feigning illness to finish War and Peace, which I read precociously early. And at the end of War and Peace, there's this extraordinary essay about the nature of history, which transfixed me. And I remember thinking at that time, well, I'm probably not clever enough to be a scientist. The rest of my family are scientists. I'm the black sheep of the family. But clearly history is something that is capable of being studied in a serious and rigorous way, and I should try and do that.
Yes. I mentioned in the intro that you are controversial. What I'm going to say right now is that I think we're not going to delve into some of the past controversies that have happened, but I'm going to mention them in case some of the audience is going to say, why didn't you bring up that? I mean, you have been, leaving aside the war in Iraq, you have been accused too positive about empire, an apologist for colonial regimes and so on. In some of your earlier books, I haven't read those books. I'm not in the position to talk about
Terry,
that.
For the record, what the books that you're talking about did, first Empire and then Colossus, was to draw up what you might call a balance sheet of empire, and to show that there were both benefits and costs of large-scale international organizations like empires. And this, of course, is actually not a controversial point at all, unless you think that every single thing about empire is bad, as, of course, some people coming out of that kind of Leninist tradition do. But remember the scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, when I think it's the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Judea says, what do the Romans ever do for us? And somebody says, aqueducts? Apart from the aqueducts. Roads? Apart from the roads. Public order? Apart from public order. What do the Romans ever do for us? Well, once you've seen that scene and understood its point, you see that to say everything about empire is bad is silly. Clearly, everything about the Roman Empire was not bad. And in the same way, everything about American power in the post-45 era wasn't bad. Ask anybody in Berlin to come back to that city. Clearly, we have to understand empires as being both capable of evil, unquestionably, but at the same time capable of generating what economists call public goods.
Okay, and let me just share that I once was in conversation with the leader of a tribe from the rainforest of Ecuador who had their first contact with missionaries in 1975, I believe. So this is someone who was born in prehistory. No offense to your career. But I expected, you know, nothing but ill to be said of the missionaries. And in fact, he said, no, they stopped us from killing each other.
Well, this is an important point the War of the World goes to, because prehistoric societies were very violent. And one of the puzzles about the 20th century is that similar kinds of very primitive tribal conflict occurred in remarkably developed societies. And this is a great paradox. The 20th century is the era of unparalleled economic progress. And yet people in certain places and at certain times revert to what you might call the prehistoric tribal order, which is an extremely violent order. And yes, I think this is why we have to be cautious when we use terms like civilization, and we must be very careful not to load them morally. But just to give you a similar example, I went to Sierra Leone when I was working on my book on the British Empire, and I'd never been to that country before. It had just emerged from a terrible civil war, and it had emerged partly because of a British military intervention. And an old man came up to us in the street and said, "Thank God for Britain." I couldn't believe my ears. I never really thought I'd hear somebody in sub-Saharan Africa say something like that. I think it makes much the same point that you've just made.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is the paradox is progress, what we call civilization, mass communications, science, all these wonderful things, side by side. Especially, I suppose, the Holocaust being the greatest contradiction of an advanced country. Unlike Stalin, Soviet Union was less developed than Germany was.
Right.
And so even though he may have murdered more, it still is that. But there's a book that you may be aware of called A Force More Powerful. I'm forgetting the two authors' name, but the point they make, and this was written right, it was a PBS series as well as a book, and the point they make, it was written right at the turn of the century, was that while we think of the 20th century actually as a bloody century, as a century of nuclear weapons, etc., that it was also the century of civil disobedience and non-violent change.
Yes, I know some of that work on nonviolent resistance. Of course, one of the interesting things about it is how little, if you like, nonviolent organized process there was compared with the amount of violent conflict. And that raises a fundamental question about the nature of human organization. Why, for example, did Gandhi's message ultimately not take root in the process that led to the partition of India in 1947? 47 is a very important part of the story, because when I'm trying to illustrate the point that it's when empires decline and fall that violence often spikes, what happened in the partition of India is a very, very good illustration of this, because it was clearly the bloodiest year in the whole of the history of British India. And it's no coincidence, I think, that it was the last year. Because once the imperial authorities are going, that's when the stakes are suddenly very high. That's when the majority sees the opportunity to, if you like, tyrannize the minority, and the minority feels so threatened that it may be driven from its homes. That's the kind of conflict that interests me. And unfortunately, it seems to dominate non-violent conflict resolution in much of the 20th century.
I will just say that the book cites 33 different instances throughout the century of successful nonviolent change. And what they say is never before had that much nonviolent change been successful, partly because of mass communication.
Hey, listen, this is a critical point. Not everything about the 20th century is catastrophic. Only about 1 in 22 deaths is violent. Extreme violence is the exception, thank heavens. There only were 16 conflicts which had a million or more deaths. Most people, let's not forget this, led peaceful lives. I've led a peaceful life. I haven't heard a shot fired in anger. And in that sense, we don't want to overdraw this story. What I'm interested in are the exceptional disasters and understanding why they came about, because it's quite localized. Violence is not universally occurring. It doesn't happen everywhere. It doesn't happen every year. And really, a critical part of the book's argument is to establish why certain places like, say, Ukraine after 1904 were so much more dangerous than, Canada.
Mm-hmm. And the point I was making was not to contradict what you'd said, but to merely say there were three things at play. There was the progress people look at, there was the violence you point out, and there was this other strain also, that it just makes the paradox all the more. One of the things you did mention in this sort of scenario, as you sort of say, that gets repeated, is when empires break down, violence erupts. I think I saw one that was empire breakdown, ethnic conflict, violence. Is this just that suddenly there's the moment where assertion matters, where who's going to rule the next stage?
I think it's about that. clearly, if you go back to the world of 1900, it was a world of empires and of multi-ethnic empires. I worked out that about 82% of the world's population in 1900 lived in one empire or another. And these empires were characterized by their enormous size and therefore their extraordinary heterogeneity. I mean, these were not homogeneous societies. And in an interesting way, the process of globalization that we know so well was at work then. And globalization
mass migration. Many people, I notice, are not aware of that. And you pointed out that era was the peak prior to perhaps now. But that there was a dip afterwards, but that the integration in 1900 was phenomenal.
Part of what I'm talking about is the last great collapse of globalization. The first era of globalization, when the world economy really did become integrated, was from around the 1880s to 1914. And my book's partly about how that went wrong. And I think there's something tremendously important to be learnt about that. And one of the ways in which it went wrong was that as a result of enormous levels of migration, in relative terms, probably more than in our own time, you created a whole cosmopolitan world of multi-ethnic commercial cities. These were the hubs of globalization, where trade went on and where different ethnic groups came together. Now, under an empire, all kinds of different ethnic groups can be not equals, but they may be in some kind of hierarchy, but they are able to coexist. That was true in the Ottoman Empire or in the Habsburg Empire. The trouble is that along came the proposition of nationalism, that everybody should really live in a nice homogenous nation state. That was Woodrow Wilson's vision of how Europe should be transformed after the First World War. And it worked terribly badly, because when you apply it to very mixed up heterogeneous parts of the world, like Central and Eastern Europe or the Balkans, it's actually impossible to create nice, neat nation states. In places like Poland or Czechoslovakia in the 1920s, more than a third of the population were members of minorities. And these minorities were big, and they felt distinctly threatened by what 19th century theorists called the tyranny of the majority. And part of what I try and show in the book is that in these kind of countries, there really was a tyranny of the majority. If you were in a minority like the Jews in Poland, you were subject to all kinds of discrimination. So what I'm talking about is how very painful for ethnic minorities it was to move from a world of empires into a world of nation states. It's actually, generally speaking, worse if you're an ethnic minority to be in a nation state than to be in an empire.
Unless you're the majority. And even then it might be worse because you may have to fight.
Well, the majorities may not benefit, and in many ways they didn't. After all, Poland was, if anything, the most dangerous country in the world, and the people who suffered in many ways the most in terms of violent death in the late 30s, early 40s were Poles, and Poles and Jews alike were victims, ultimately, of that second great phase of what you might call an evil empire, when new empires have formed. Nazi Germany is one, the Soviet Union is another.
Well,
empires in some ways are new and different and much more destructive than the old ones.
Let me jump. You mentioned that it was Wilson's idea that we have a League of Nations, that we have nation states, and that these nation states be, you were saying, homogeneous.
Yeah.
Ethnically homogeneous.
Of course, that idea had been around from nationalist theorists in the 19th century, but Wilson says, let's make this the base of a new world order.
How do you explain, and I'm perfectly willing for you to make analogies to the present in doing so, why the notion of Aryan purity, Aryan superiority, all of that had so much resonance? One of the things you point out that I was not aware of is that in Hitler's early years, at least, his appeal was not just to the lumpen proletariat who didn't know better. His appeal was across the board and very much to what might have been the intellectuals, what might have been the business class, and so on. I sort of can't get my head around it. You spent a lot of time studying it. That, also what Stalin did, which was somewhat similar. What is the attraction of that?
I think it's important to realize how cutting-edge biological theories of racism seemed to be in 1900. I mean, they really were, if you like, the things that smart people thought about. And that wasn't peculiar to, say, Germany. We know, in fact, that biologically based racial legislation was quite widespread in the United States.
Laws against miscegenation.
Right, the laws against miscegenation had been pioneered in the United States.
You mentioned that Hitler copies our laws.
And Hitler explicitly says that the inspiration behind the Nuremberg laws, which are designed to prevent Jews and Aryans, quote-unquote, from having sex or getting married, the inspiration's American. So this was very much a global phenomenon. I talk about the way the idea of biologically constructed race is almost universal. You find it everywhere. And it's hard for us, because it's now so discredited, to appreciate that it was the height of intellectual fashion. And that's why the best universities in the world, which were in Germany in the 1920s, were full of people who understood or believed they understood the way the world worked. And the way the world seemed to work to them was that there was a hierarchy of race. And the Aryans were at the top of it, and somewhere near the bottom were Jews.
When you cite numbers of books and you quote writers from the time making these sorts of claims, I must say it is difficult for me not to think, oh, that's like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, but it's not. That was on the extreme.
Right.
But you're saying that the mainstream cutting-edge thinking, actually the textbooks and so on, would include these hierarchies.
Yes. Yes, I mean, theories of eugenics that said you have to avoid degeneration of the race by making sure that criminals don't have children were absolutely at the forefront of social theory at that
time.
And
did this grow out?
Not just in Central Europe.
Did this grow out somewhat from Darwinism?
It was a sort of perversion of Darwinism. The so-called social Darwinists took Darwin's ideas and misapplied them to human society.
In other words, where we see the Neanderthal crawl, you know, that picture that is so archetypal of the crawling up to an erect position, they took that and took it to the next step, where it was with certain races at the bottom, and you'd evolve until you became Aryan?
Or the fear was rather different, that the human race might actually decline, degenerate, as a result of a kind of negative form of natural selection, where the weak would be protected by a corrupt state, and the racially inferior human beings would reproduce more than the racially superior ones. And these ideas are tremendously widespread. They're not peculiar to one country. They're not a peculiarity of Germany. It's just that in Germany, these ideas are taken to their most extreme and hideous conclusion. That they're, in a sense, that they're taken to the reductio ad absurdum, where you finally decide, look, we can't deal with this problem any other way than by eradicating this inferior race.
Right, and as you point out, the other conditions for that, the condition of the oppression of Germany after World War I and the particular unique charisma of Hitler and so
right.
on.
I mean, one of the puzzles in the book is, why do two countries that have so much in common, the United States and Germany, that experience pretty much as bad a depression as each other, have such different political outcomes?
Let me just tell people, there is a wonderful way you start chapter 2 or 3 or something, where you go about a page and a half with a newly elected leader saying the extreme measures that are going to have to be taken to revive that society from the Depression, and you know the reader thinks you're quoting Hitler and you're quoting Roosevelt.
Right. I mean, Roosevelt's first inaugural is full of the most extraordinary demagogic stuff about stock exchange speculators, the money changers need to be chased out of the temple, you need to have a military-type solution, and he even threatens to override the Constitution. And you read this, if you don't know who it is, you could quite easily think that it's another leader who came to power in 1933, namely Hitler. So part of the question I wanted to address was, in a sense, why was Germany not the United States? Why, in this crisis, was the result, the outcome, so much worse in Germany? And I think that brings us back to this peculiar context of Central and Eastern Europe, where beyond Germany's borders, there are German minorities who feel terribly insecure in places like Czechoslovakia, indeed in Austria. And these are the people that Hitler mobilizes and leads to a terrible war.
And, I mean, yeah, it's freeing those Germans, or getting them to become part of a greater Germany that
right.
leads to the initial...
The idea conflict. Of living space is crucial in this.
Right. You were in favor of the war in Iraq at its origin. Let's deal with the contemporary. Mm-hmm. I'm going to read you a quote from your book, page 333, when you're talking about Chamberlain and the policy of appeasement. Mm-hmm. Faster and greater rearmament in the mid-1930s might not look affordable to the Treasury, but how much more expensive would it be in the 40s if Hitler were to succeed in dominating the continent and if Germany, Italy, and Japan chose to make common case against the British Empire? This hypothetical worst-case scenario was wished away by most decision-makers, an act of negligence, since politicians have an implicit moral obligation to those whom they represent regularly to contemplate the worst case, to attach to it both a probability and an estimated cost, and then to insure against it. It was this that both Baldwin and Chamberlain failed to do, an irony in view of their personal experience of business. As you did with Roosevelt and Hitler, one could use that very much to describe the Bush administration.
Yes, I think that's right. I look back over my journalism in 2003 recently to see if I had really blundered badly, and I think I don't come out of it as badly as I'd feared, because my argument from even before 2003 was that if the United States was going to intervene in Iraq, it had to recognize that this was an imperial project. It would require a lot of men, it would require a lot of money and it would require a lot of time. And my great worry was that the people in Washington didn't understand any of this, didn't know the history of the country, and thought that it could be done as a sort of cut-price colonial enterprise in and out in a 2 to 4 year time frame. I was pessimistic the more time I spent in Washington. I got very uneasy about what I heard when I talked to neoconservatives who appeared to know staggeringly little about Iraq's past, including, of course, the British invasion of Iraq in 1917. Nobody seemed to see the insurgency coming.
I mean, I really want to talk about this one because it seems to me so crucial, because clearly you're someone who has a wide view. And yet, when did you pull away? When did you turn against the invasion, at least?
Well, I think it was pretty early on that I warned that the three American deficits, the financial deficit, the manpower deficit, and the attention deficit, would bedevil this undertaking. That was in the conclusion of the book Empire, which asked at the end whether the United States really was capable of playing the kind of role the British Empire played. So I think I had my doubts early on.
I'm wondering when you went in print and said either this was a mistake or it's becoming one.
Well, the great turning point that leaps to mind was an article I wrote in 2004 before the presidential election, which the Wall Street Journal published, called Republicans for Kerry, in which I urged conservatives to vote for Kerry because I'd by that time realized that something really quite disastrous was going wrong with the administration. I think, you know, I'm an outsider. I only really arrived and started to teach in the United States literally on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. And I think if I was naive about the Bush administration, then I can at least plead ignorance. Whereas there were many people in the United States who spent their whole lives here who were naive and I think who are on a much less secure ground. But I was certainly naive. I don't think anything would have led me to expect the kind of incompetence and unrealism
Let me make two points. I actually did some public debates prior to the invasion. And the point I would ultimately make would be two. One would be that I thought the justifications didn't exist. You know, if it's weapons of mass destruction, then just continue inspections, perhaps indefinitely. Yeah. If it's alliance with Al-Qaeda, it's not true.
Yeah.
So that was one thing. The second one was, if those justifications were true, the idea of preemptive war, it strikes me, rises to a higher standard than war of self-defense. And then I just looked at those people and I said, these are not leaders capable of this. You show in your look at history that you look at big forces, but you also look at individuals.
Sure.
You spend time on Chamberlain versus Churchill. And when I looked at Bush, Rumsfeld, Cheney, the neocons, I thought, these are not competent people. These are not the people I entrust preemptive war to. That's the first point I'll make. Let me make a second one so you can respond to both. The next one is that what I saw was that the basic line was, we're going to remove a brutal dictator and we will be greeted as liberators. Mm. In a country that has been ruled by the minority, and this goes back to your ethnic groups.
Absolutely.
A country that has been ruled by the minority, if we do that, how could you look at that situation and say we're going to take the rule away from the minority, and in a democracy it will go to the majority, and think that the people who've been in power, even though they were the minority, are going to greet you as liberators?
I think on the question of competence, of course, it looked much more impressive in the immediate aftermath of the invasion of Afghanistan. And I think this is the Woodward trajectory.
I mean,
Woodward,
I know it is.
In volume one,
I'd be saying the same things to him.
Sees Bush as a tremendous leader. It's only now that the scales have rather belatedly fallen from his eyes.
Right. Were he there, I'd be saying the same thing.
But I think, there was at least the impression of military competence. And one assumed that the Defense Department knew what it was doing, quite aside from Bush's obvious limitations as a president. But I think the second question you raise about the likely consequences of instant democratization of a country like Iraq is very well taken. I mean, I think there was a genuine ignorance about what might happen between Sunnis and Shias, to say nothing of Kurds, on the part of some of the key decision makers. And I think that's something that can also be said of the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who should have known a lot better, but turns out to have been pitifully ignorant of the British experience in Iraq, which was, after all, quite an education. I mean, the British were there from 1917 right through to the mid-1950s and experienced all kinds of ups and downs and bumps in that time. The history of that period was just absent, missing without trace during the debates about the invasion of Iraq. And one final point, which I think I would plead guilty about. I think we all underestimated, with very few exceptions, the balance of power implications of taking Iraq's rulers out. It's Iran that's turned out to be the principal beneficiary, and it will be the supreme irony if Iran ends up acquiring WMD on Bush's watch.
Yes. Well, we'll leave it at that. I would like to pick this up again at some point, Neil.
It's not going to go away, this issue,
exactly.
Is it, Terry?
No, I mean the conversation. Let me tell people, the book is The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West, and we never got even to the Descent of the West. The website is www.neilferguson.org, and that's N-I-A-L-L, Ferguson.org. Thank you, Neil Ferguson. Keep up the tough work.
Thanks.
The previous interview with Neil Ferguson was recorded on his recent trip to Los Angeles prior to the election and prior to the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, and that is why we did not refer to those events in the course of the interview.